Welcome, everyone. I'm Pam Stack. This is Authors on the Air. We're proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. This is a very, very special edition of the show today. I recently returned from Thriller Fest in New York City, which is the International Thriller Writers Worldwide Conference. The best and the brightest attend this conference. And while I was there, in between doing shows and listening to panels, I had the distinct honor and privilege of meeting British writer Adam Hamdy. Adam is considered a rising star in Amazon. He is a British author and screenwriter who works on both sides of the pond. He writes for television and movies. He is also the author of a brilliant series of conspiracy thriller novels called the Pendulum series. It's my pleasure to welcome to Authors on the Air, author Adam Hamdy. Adam, welcome and good evening.
Good evening. Thank you very much for having me, Pam. It's lovely to be talking to you again.
Thank you. I want to say by way of just a little admission, you and I were introduced to this by KJ Howe, a mutual friend, and we kind of stood in the hallway outside the book room for a few minutes and decided to go sit down in the book room when it was empty. Our quick little 5-minute conversation turned into a 2-hour one, which was absolutely delightful. And I thank you for spending that time with me.
Well, thank you as well. I mean, I lost track of time completely, and I felt like we were setting the world to rights.
I think we did. We solved all the problems, didn't we?
We did. It's a shame no one was there to listen.
We were brilliant, I think.
Completely unbiased.
There you go. One of the things I find very interesting, Adam, is that many of the authors I speak to from Great Britain are also philosophy majors in college and in university. You have a philosophy degree, do you not?
I feel like I'm on trial. Should I plead the fifth?
You should talk. And there's a reason I'm asking you that. I think that when I was reading your books, I think you answer or at least raise a lot of very interesting human questions in your books, whether it's how a killer's mind works or what justification they have or motivation for a crime. And also the protagonists, how they react and act when they are targeted as for crime.
Yeah. It's interesting. I initially trained as a lawyer and got a law degree, and then I know a lot of authors who are also lawyers, fantastic authors who have trained as lawyers. Obviously, John Grisham being mm-hmm. probably the most famous. But I think law didn't help me answer some of the sort of big questions that I felt I needed to ask, and so I did the philosophy degree afterwards, and I try and bring some of those questions and some of those themes that I consider to be universals to what I write. And, you know, they are fast-paced, action-packed thrillers, but I try and sneak in some of those big themes and some of those big questions. And for Pendulum, the big question was what would happen to you if you had committed this terrible wrong without even realizing it? And technology is allowing us to be connected to people in really unusual and new ways that we've never been connected to people in the past. And we're able to influence and impact each other's lives without even realizing it. And I wanted to look at what happens if one of those connections goes really badly wrong.
Yeah, boy, I'll tell you that one kind of set off the whole chain of events with a lot of people in Pendulum, the first book. Would you give kind of an overview, maybe the elevator pitch, as it were, about Pendulum and the subsequent stories that follow along with it?
Yeah. So with Pendulum, it opens with photojournalist John Wallace returning to consciousness to find that he's been bound and blindfolded by a masked man who's preparing to hang him in his own living room. He's got a noose around his neck. He's standing on a chair. and he's about to die. And fate intervenes and allows him to escape. And so Pendulum is the story of him and two law enforcement agents, a Metropolitan Police officer, Patrick Bailey, and FBI agent, Christine Ash, who help John Wallace find out why he's been targeted, because it is for something specific. It's not a random attack. And they help him find out why he's been targeted, and they help him survive this killer who keeps coming at him. And then my new book, Freefall, which is actually out in America this week. It came out yesterday. It tells the story of the same three protagonists, Wallace, Bailey, and Ash, as they're sucked into a bigger conspiracy that's the legacy of Pendulum. And again, it's another big theme. It's a group of people who've got together in secret to reshape the world. And given the political environment, obviously I wrote this, started work on it a couple of years ago, and given the political environment in which we live, the idea of people getting together and working behind the scenes, conspiring to reshape the world is quite a topical one. So it's something that I look at in Freefall. Yeah.
It is remarkably close to what we're seeing right now. How prophetic of you to do that. You know, it's now you have another book that in the series, the final one in the series, called Aftershock. When will that be released?
That will be released in the US next July, and it comes out in the UK in November this year, and that is the final part of the trilogy, and it picks up certainly some of the characters from Freefall. And Aftershock actually deals with the question of belief and how easy it is for people to believe if they hear the right things. And there's somebody that I consider to be one of my favorite characters who comes into the book and is able to use his expertise and skills to subvert the group that Wallace and Ash and Bailey are up against, and to repurpose them for his own objectives. And it's really looking at how easy it is now in this day and age, when people hear what they want to hear, how easy it is for someone who's prepared to tell them what they want to hear to manipulate them and to take them down a very dark path.
You know, in the green room, you and I were talking about your characters. I said to you, you know that I'm a very prolific reader. We've talked about that in the past. I had to and intentionally wanted to take my time reading your books. They are not your average thrillers. I think they're for someone who has the patience and the dedication to really immerse themselves in some brilliant storytelling. But one thing that I found with your books that I don't find in the majority of books that are out there was your characters, both protagonists and antagonists, feel the consequences of their actions, whether they are victims or victimizers. There is a lasting impression on both. Not often in the way we're going to expect it. I'm so impressed by that, because as a survivor of a violent crime, I have to tell you, I've never seen it explored quite the way you did in these books, because all three of your protagonists are some way or the other victims of a crime. And I don't want to give any much more away than that, but it was amazing to me that you just nailed it so well, which begs the question, how did you know? How did you know?
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for that. I mean, I grew up, spent a lot of my time in London. As a child, I lived there I was born there and I lived there until I was eight. And I came from quite inauspicious beginnings. I was from a working class family. My parents struggled to pay the bills when they were, you know, sort of a young couple just starting out. They would hide from the landlord. I mean, you know, we didn't have much at all. And some of my friends growing up were from the wrong side of the tracks. I mean, there's no getting away from it. And so mm-hmm. I saw people who were victims of domestic violence. I saw people who were criminals. I saw both sides, victims and criminals. And I grew up surrounded by them and sort of looking at the psychological consequences. You don't really understand what you're sort of experiencing as a child.
Right.
But looking back in hindsight, I can see the damage of people who, you know, there's one particular criminal who I was friends with, his son. He was an alcoholic. He was a very self-destructive person. And I, looking back, think that it was because of what he was doing with his life and the guilt that he carried with him. It was leading him down this self-destructive path. And then when I was 8, we moved to Egypt, which is where my father was from. And that was in the mid-1980s, and that was a country that was coming off the back of a war, and there was still rationing. And I had things happen like school friends would go and play on the beach at the Red Sea, and the beaches had been mined during the war. And so there was one particular instance I knew of where one of the kids from the school I went to was actually killed in a...
My God.
Blown up by a mine. And his parents had been...
Oh, my God.
Yeah, they'd been irresponsible because there are signs up on these beaches saying, don't play here. But, you know, people would often ignore the warnings. And so I grew up in that kind of environment where these sort of things could happen. And they do have an impact on you, obviously. You know, as a child, that's something that's, you know, harmful and terrifying. And I've also... you know, had experience of people within, you know, my circle of friends and family who've had, you know, been victims of violence, neighbors when we lived in London, you know, when I came back, my teenage years and later on when I was an adult and living away from, you know, in my own house and stuff, we had neighbors who were attacked with, mugged with baseball bats. And you,
oh my gosh.
You've got your, you know, your eyes and ears open. Violence is all around us, and you sort of, it's easy to just read the news or watch the news and move on from it. But actually, if you get to know these people, if you talk to people, if they're in your circle of friends and family, you can see the effects and the impact that, and they go on for years and years and years. And you know, obviously we talked about your experiences.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I'm really struck by how well you've recovered from them and managed to sort of grow beyond them. And
thank you.
For a lot of people, it's really difficult. They carry that baggage with them. And so I wanted to give that sense of reality in my books and make sure that I showed the consequences of what these people do.
Well, you certainly did. It was brilliant. Right on the money. It was remarkable to me. It's just a remarkable read. Will you please tell me what a CPSA marksman is?
So this is something I got into actually when I was researching a feature film script that I was writing. I needed to know how guns were made.
Mm-hmm.
And I went and hung out with a local gunsmith, gun manufacturer, and also with a shooting coach who took me to the local clay pigeon shooting ground. I think you call it skeet shooting in America.
Okay.
Yeah, and showed me how to do it. And so... it was something that I took up it's an interesting activity. I do clay pigeon skeet shooting competitively, and I also rock climb, and they're both quite similar because they force you to be in the moment. You cannot think about anything else while you're climbing or shooting, you know, difficult targets. You have to focus on what you're doing. So it's actually a really good way of clearing the mind. It's, you know, my wife does yoga, and it's, you know, I've been told by a lot of people who do climbing and that it's a very similar experience to yoga, but it's something that allows me to clear my mind. And so the CPSA is the Clay Pigeon Shooting Association, and I recently became a gold marksman, which is
congratulations.
I'm quite pleased about. Yeah, thank you.
I would imagine any single-minded activity where you have to be focused exactly on what you're doing in the moment is a very zen experience. To me, it's painting baseboards in my house.
I can understand that. Yeah, it's very therapeutic.
But, you know, you have to
Yeah, you have to concentrate. You can't be have your hands waving around. You know, I talk with my hands a lot, and so things like that are, you know, other tasks I can mind wanders too much on me, Adam. So I can relate to it completely. Of course, I'm not climbing rocks. I'm not a skier, and I'm not shooting skeet. I'm scared to death of guns, any kind. So, I don't even have a water pistol. So.
Wow. Well, I was much the same as you. Actually, I was really very very skeptical of guns, and very scared of them. As far as I was concerned, they're actually just weapons, and you know, they're only ever in the hands of the police or bad guys, really. And then I got introduced to the world and got to understand what it's actually about. And unlike America, in the UK we go through really rigorous checks to get our licenses. I think there's about 600,000, maybe it's 300,000, there's hundreds of thousands of shotgun owners in the UK, and they've gone through quite rigorous checks to get their licenses. So I'm less afraid of them than I used to be. But I understand.
Well,
I understand
also
completely.
It's a different kind of a weapon, though, isn't it? It's you know, if you're clay shooting versus hunting, and instead of arming yourself with a rapid fire weapon, I think it's a lot different. So
yeah.
I'm just scared of them in general. I grew up in Miami. You know, it's not the crime capital, but it certainly is not completely safe all the time. So
no.
You know, I'm very aware, and I worked for the police department, so I know, you know, what it's like. I've been on plenty of crime scenes. It's not that much fun. I want to go back to talk about writing. You also are a screenwriter. You write for film, and primarily film, but some television, I understand. How has the screenwriting helped your book writing?
That's a really good question. I started screenwriting first because I'd always been terrified of books. For me, growing up, I came from, you know, like, as I said, I came from not particularly, beginnings. And for me, it was never, writing was never a career option. Where I went to school, it was just something that was never even talked about as something that you could do. And so, when I decided to start pursuing a career as a writer, I started with screenwriting because it seemed less daunting for me. There's a translation process involved. You work with a team, and you have a producer and a director, and so you're carrying less of the load, I think, as a writer. That's certainly what I went into it believing. As a novelist, to me, growing up reading Stephen King, Tom Clancy, Michael Crichton, you know, Thomas Harris, all these, you know, great authors of the modern era, Emily Bronte, Alexander Dumas, classics, that always seemed superhuman to me, because you're building a world, you're directly communicating with the reader, and you're fashioning something incredible out of nothing. And so I'd always been daunted by books, and it was probably about, I think it was 2008, when I thought, I'm going to write a book because I don't like being afraid of things. And as I was doing my first book, I found that the screenwriting was really helping, but not the way that I'd expected. So obviously it helps you visualize things, because you have to learn how to convey information visually. You can't do internal monologue in a film unless you've got voiceover, and that's, you know, a lot of people struggle
cheesy.
To do that effectively.
It's cheesy.
It can be, yeah. So it's difficult to do that. So, you know, you learn that visual storytelling technique, obviously, from screenwriting. But the other thing that I'd learned, and you learn this from years of notes from producers and from studios and from executives, is actually the importance of character and motivation and realism. And people think, well, you know, TV or film, that they can be somehow less focused on character. But actually, it drives everything. It informs everything. I've never come across a producer, no matter whether they've been a good producer or a bad producer to work with, who hasn't been obsessed with character. Sometimes they might misunderstand what character is, but they're obsessed with it. And you learn that discipline of motivation, character, realism, and showing character through action. That's, you know, it's something that is essential in film. It's how do you show character as economically as possible? And that's one of the things that has always stuck with me as I've come, you know, to writing books with that, with from a screenwriting background.
I hear what you're saying. You know, the words economy stick out to me. When you're writing dialogue, I had a conversation with a book reviewer about this the other day. I ask a lot of authors if they read their dialogue out loud, and they say no. And I'm always surprised, because writing on a page filled with dialogue is static until someone gives voice to it. Isn't it? Aren't you supposed to read what your characters are saying out loud so you can hear it for yourself?
I think that's it's a really good technique to read things out loud. And I did a panel at Thriller Fest, and one of the authors said that she read her entire book out loud to find out what mm-hmm. was working, what wasn't, where the energy lagged, where things needed to be picked up, things that needed to be edited, and that sort of thing. There are functions on the latest versions of screenwriting software like Final Draft where you can actually have the machine read your dialogue and set whether you want the voice to be male or female. Or so you, even if you feel uncomfortable doing it yourself, you can have the robot read your dialogue out loud. I think it's really important to understand the rhythm and flow of how things are reading. But of course, with a book, the one thing you can't control is the fact that your reader is going to be bringing their own voice to everything that you write. So you might have a particular idea of what a character sounds like or how they speak, but someone else is going to apply their own pattern when they read that book. So I think you have a limited amount of control, but I certainly think that reading stuff out loud definitely helps.
Yeah, I'm thinking that a few things, so I'll kind of approach them one at a time. One, when I listen to an author read from his book, I'm struck either by how way apart I am from what the author is reading his own words, or how close I am. And I'm always amused by those two things. The second thing is that I wonder if a writer is uncomfortable reading their own words, and if someone shouldn't be reading that book out loud to the writer to at least have another opinion. I think we may have talked about this, Adam, I don't remember, but when you read out loud versus you're reading quietly, your different parts of your brain are happening, they're functioning. And I think that you should engage as many of those things as you can in the process. I might be wrong, but even as a reader, when dialogue is particularly strong or melodious to me, I will read it myself. I want to hear it over and over and over. I want it to register. The other thing is, and you know, feel free to jump in. I wonder how you feel about hearing your books on Audible. So all of those are different methods of communicating story. How does a writer feel about all that?
Yeah, well, I mean, as far as dialogue's concerned, I think one of the things to do particularly as a screenwriter, but also as an author, is to listen to as many people as you can and how they talk, and to listen to as many different types of people, different social classes, different ethnic backgrounds, to keep abreast of the new ways people have of talking, because language is changing all the time. And, you know, there are entire subcultures that spring up, particularly now with the internet. They spring up and they spread so quickly. It's so important, I think, to keep on top of how people are talking and adjust your characters to what is happening. And if you're writing a period book, obviously you need them to speak convincingly for that time, but I read some books, not very many, but I read some books where the dialogue is basically used as a way to get through exposition and to mm-hmm. move the plot along, and it's functional. There's no real difference in the way that people talk. There's no difference in their rhythm. There's no difference in their use of language.
How do you feel about that?
Well, you know, I mean, I'm one of these people that just like a good story. And I'll, you know, I'm not kind of, I don't know what the word is. I'm not snobbish in terms of, does it have to be, you know, beautifully written? Does every book have to be a literary prize winner? No, I don't think it does. I think if a story engages me and, you know, it's compelling, I will just go with it. But I think if you want to, as an author, if you want to evolve and improve, you've got to use your dialogue not just to advance plot. You've got to use it to reflect your characters. You've got to make them.
Yes.
You've got to use it to help them come alive. And I
to
like
be a
you.
Part of the character. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm like you. If I find a particularly striking bit of prose, either in dialogue or description, I love it. I love rereading it for the rhythm or for the. You know, for the beauty of it. And I think one particular book that always stands out for me for this is actually Lord of the Rings. You know, some of the songs in there, some of the descriptions, some of the language, just absolutely stunning. But in terms of hearing the book on Audible, I'm always amazed at what because most publishers will hire actors to deliver the audiobook, and I'm always amazed to hear what the actors bring in terms of performance and interpretation, and sometimes it can just surprise you. I'm not uncomfortable about it at all. I think, as you say, I think as an author, you need to be used to reading your own work, hearing it out loud, hearing it being delivered by other people. Although I can talk and speak in public, I'm not a huge fan of the author reading. But I do them if needed. But in terms of hearing other people read my work and reading it to myself privately, I think it's just such a useful thing.
I'm not a fan of Audible or audiobooks in general because my mind is cluttered enough as it is, and it becomes ambient noise to me, and I will fade off. I can't stay in the story listening to somebody read to me, unless it's you know, somebody reading a brief piece in front of me, or listening to Flash or something like that. But I will lose part of the story if I listen to an audiobook. And sometimes when I drive back to Miami, it's, you know, 2.5 hour trip, I could certainly be listening to an audiobook, but I don't. I feel like I've missed too much of it. So I'm not a really good one to tell you whether or not they're, I mean, people tell me they love audiobooks. That's how they get through stories. And I'm all for whatever format it takes for people to read. But for me, I'm more immersed in it by reading it or silently or out loud or both, hopefully, you know, and not every book you can do that. I will tell you, because I read across genre, I read a lot of debut novelists who ask that I read their work for review. And, I want to take them by the shoulders and say, your female and your male characters speak exactly the same. The rhythm, the timbre, the flow, it's all the same. I want dialogue to be so good that when your three characters are talking, I don't need to have you say, this is Ash, this is Wallace, or this is Bailey. I want to know who they are. Does that make sense, Adam?
Oh yeah, completely. I think that's the objective for any author, is to be able to identify the characters without any indicators. I think that's absolutely crucial. And I think also the same is true in film and TV. You should be able to distinguish between your characters without any visual markers.
Yes, I agree with you. I don't go to a lot of films now, and as you know, I don't own a television, so I'm the worst person to ask about that. But if you had to only choose one, would you choose between screenwriting and novel writing, or would you try something different?
Oh, my babies, you're going to make me make a choice.
if you can't, you can't. I would never have you make a choice. But, you know, so the question is, would you like to try something else in the arts? You're very creative.
I'm really happy, actually. I get paid to write books, and I get paid to write for screen. I couldn't think of anything better in the world to be doing. Maybe that will change in the future. But right now, I've been working towards this for over a decade. It's finally sort of coming together for me now, and I'm really happy with it. I can honestly, hand on heart, say I'm content, and I don't think there's not been many times in my life when I could say that. So I'm really pleased with it, and I get different things out of them. So I'd like to, as much as possible, carry on writing both books and also writing for screen.
I hope that you do. I don't know anything about your screen work, but I do love your books. And
oh, thank you very
having
much.
Said that, I want to give away a signed copy of Pendulum that you've kindly sent to me. So the first person who goes on my Facebook page and says, hey, I heard this interview and I want Pendulum signed, I will send it to them.
Oh, wow.
Adam Hamdy, thank you so much for spending your evening with me when you could be with your wife and beautiful children. I look forward to seeing you at BoucherCon should the moon align with Mars and you can make it. Otherwise, perhaps I'll see you next time at Thriller Fest.
Absolutely.
It's been a pleasure speaking to you. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me, Pam. It's been an absolutely wonderful experience, and I look forward to seeing you again soon.
As do I, Adam. Thank you and have a good night.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And that's our show, folks. Thank you for being with me. If you want, find me on Facebook, either on Authors on the Air or me, Pam Stack. And tell me you heard the show, you liked it, and I'll send you a copy. Have a great day, and thank you, Mom and Dad.